5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Oscars. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Now Show Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Sam Houston. I'm joined once again by my wonderful co-host, Lewis. Today is the first episode of our Oscars journey, our very late Oscars journey, I'll admit, in which we're going to be, in the first episode, we're going to be discussing three films, all of which have been nominated for multiple Academy Awards, all of which are kind of surrounding the discussion of Best Picture or a number of kind of top awards, and that will be Martin McDonagh's The Banshees of Inisherin, which stars Kerry Condon, Barry Keoghan, Brendan Gleeson, and Colin Farrell, all of which are nominated for acting Oscars, and follows the journey of one friend played by Colin Farrell, who wakes up one day, goes about his normal routine to find out that his best friend in life suddenly does not want to be friends with him anymore. The second film we're going to talk about is Todd Field's Tar, which features a performance from Cate Blanchett that has been particularly talked up, and is about a composer, conductor, who is embarking on her kind of tour de force, on her kind of career high, and it's all the pressure and her personal life going into that, along with some of her controversies that have been unearthed. And the third film we're going to talk about is All Quiet on the Western Front, which is a remake of a 1930 film, which itself won Best Picture, which is itself based on a book from the 20s. This is unlike the original. It's a German film, subtitles, which, you know, typically not done well at the Oscars, but after Parasite, anything is possible, of course. And particularly notable because it recently won Best Film at the BAFTA Awards. So that has kind of launched it into the conversation for the Oscars Best Picture. Which I want to quickly say before we get, well, obviously we talk about, so the part two of our Oscars specials will be an episode releasing either at the same time as this or very soon after this, which will be our nominations, predictions, discussions and such. And I probably should leave this for then, but I'd just like to say All Quiet on the Western Front is very much in the conversation with a Best Picture. And I called that really early. And you can admit this. You can vouch for me here. I called that on the day of the Oscar nominations that it's going to win Best Picture. And
you did.
That was not in the picture at the time. So I just want to say, I know it got a lot of nominations, but everyone was talking about just Everything Everywhere. And even, you know, a few weirdos saying Top Gun. And I came out of there with the All Quiet on the Western Front, which, again, was not a completely out there prediction, but it wasn't the popular one. So I just want to say that.
That is true.
So, Lewis.
Sam.
It's been a... We've not been so involved with the awards this year, have we? Last year, we were all awards focused. We were discussing all the odds. We were building up to it for weeks. We did the alternative Oscars, which we will be doing, just, you know, not so soon. We were really involved in the whole system, the whole thing that is the Oscars. But this year, neither of us have really seen that asked, have we?
No, that's true. Last year, I was really on it. And this year, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, last year, I remember watching it and being like, this is what's going to win. Yep, that happened. Or, this is what's going to win. Maybe this could happen. And yeah, that's what happened. Though, you know, I kind of knew what was going to happen. This year, I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't been following it closely. I don't know. And that's so much more exciting.
Yeah, we can watch the Oscars together, as we did last year. And we did the year before. And yes. But I don't know if I'm going to have more emotion watching it than I did last year, because I don't know what's going to win. And I've just, you know, I've just seen these films. I just know it off the quality, not necessarily off the odds and stuff. Or if, you know, I might lack the element of surprise, but I think maybe I'll lack a bit of personal stakes in it. You know, like, I don't know. Part of me feels like maybe because I'm not involved in the machine of it, I'll be kind of less bothered.
I know what you mean, but I don't feel that way. I am very invested in who I want to win, but I don't know if it's going to happen or not. But I still have my favourites.
Now, of course, you will find out whether those stakes were affected in the part three of this Oscar special when we review the Oscars. Now, that's a big promise. We're talking about three episodes in like a week for a podcast that's released three episodes in the last, I'm going to say, decade at this point. So I think that if we go three episodes back, we were reviewing the first All Quiet on the Western Front. So it's been a very long time.
It has. But we're back in full force.
Yeah. Do you like the bit of the podcast every week where I'm like, okay, now we're going to be like releasing episodes every week now. And then we don't do that. We don't do that.
It's become a thing where because at the end of every episode we say, we're going to do a Doctor Who episode next week. And then we just never do.
Oh yeah, of course, the Doctor Who episode. Oh my God. I completely forgot about the Doctor Who episode.
That we said will come out tomorrow about six months ago.
Sorry guys. Yeah.
At this point, we should save it for the 60th anniversary episode and release it then.
We should leave it at the 60th anniversary of the podcast.
Yeah.
This is like Kubrick's Lost Napoleon film. The last episode of the podcast. Yeah. By the way, big up to us for actually acing the intro. The audience won't know that we recorded this is the fifth attempt, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just kept messing up.
Well done.
Well, here we are, eh? Well done, guys. Yes. Okay. Nice. How have you been, Lewis?
I've been well, thank you. How have you been?
I've been awful, to be honest with you.
Oh, well, that's a shame. Anyway,
let's go on to what we've watched. So, this is the only time we'll be doing that for the next couple of episodes because it'd be a bit redundant otherwise. I'll go first. So last episode was Babylon, right? So I haven't seen very much. Some people will be surprised to hear that I once again have not seen much. I watched a very interesting film, actually. Woody Harrelson's, I think, directorial debut. Yeah, his only film he directed. Lost in London. Have you seen this? Have you heard about this? Do you know what this is?
I have neither seen it nor heard of it.
So I think it will be right up your alley because it is a one take.
Ooh, I'm a slut for a one take.
Yeah, I think the plot of the film is that he has just done a play, or he's just made an art show thing, which was like the audience watched him go about London for a day doing a one take. And then everyone hated it. And then the joke is that this film is doing exactly that. Anyway, he does, after his like most recent performance, like it's just like misadventure. It's just like one thing goes wrong. He ends up like having a problem with his wife. Then Owen Wilson shows up, and then he causes more problems with his wife. And then he ends up in prison. Yeah, it's a quirky little film. I think Woody Harrelson's an excellent actor. I think Woody Harrelson seems to be a decent director after this night. I think it was a very quirky little debut, and I would recommend it. Aside from that, I saw the 1954 film Godzilla. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. In the cinema on 35mm, which was an experience. Did I enjoy Godzilla? I don't know, to be honest with you. It's one of those ones where...
Oh, I thought you were going to say classic. You fell asleep.
I did sleep for 10 minutes of it, but it was 10 minutes at the start. So, look, man, I work long hours. Did I enjoy it? Kind of. You know, it's one of those old films, and obviously I've been watching a lot older films, and especially with like 1910s films. I'm just watching it for the experience. You don't really have a sense of like subjective enjoyment to it. And I felt kind of the same about Godzilla. Like, I really appreciate, obviously, like it's really impressive, but I don't think my brain ever really asked the question as was I enjoying this. I was just more like, it was more like in a history lesson, really. I guess to try and put the critic's hat on it, all the Godzilla films always focus on a human A plot to the Godzilla B plot. And the problem isn't that that's how it's done, because I think if you had just had monsters constantly, you'd run into the same problem that Monster Hunter did, which is that it's just everything lacks stakes. I don't have a problem with humans being the lead. I have a problem with uninteresting humans being the lead. I think maybe in Godzilla, like, I didn't really like the kind of the weird romance thing and the oxygen killer thing. I just wasn't really gripped by the human plot. But the Godzilla scenes are wonderful. And I will say, I actually find, even though I know it's a man in the suit, I still find it really kind of like this imposing figure. I think the big thing there is, I think you show like the amount that color still matters in black and white films, in monochrome films, because just the contrast in those Godzilla scenes, where it's just him against that pitch black, you know, Tokyo. It's very, I think it increases the scale. I think it adds a kind of sense more of a fear to it. I don't know. I just think that it's shot very, very well. And again, a very good example of black and white cinematography. Waffled a bit there. I saw Creed 3. I went to the press screening of Creed 3, which is, I'm not going to say my opinion on that because I think we're going to review it. But yeah, Creed 3, I saw Creed 3. Who knows? You know, you can't judge. I also watched Sherlock Jr., the Buster Keaton film from 1924, silent comedy. It's the first feature silent comedy I've seen. I've watched a lot of silent comedy shorts, especially Chaplin, but I haven't actually sat through a feature. Now, this one's very much on the edge of, is it a feature? It's only 45 minutes long, but I think, especially seeing as, you know, the time, if using time context, that definitely would have been considered a feature at the time. And yeah, I really enjoyed Sherlock Jr. I think, you know, slapstick still is always going to work. It's going to work now. It worked in 1924, and it'll probably work in another 100 years. Yeah, it was enjoyable. I think I'm maybe slightly more suited to Chaplin style than Keaton style, but I will admit that Buster Keaton style is a lot more intelligent. But yeah, really, really engaging. Really, I love the dream sequence. I love the way that, you know, the cinema fourth wall is quite visually broken. And yeah, and him trying to balance his two jobs. Very, very funny, very interesting. I enjoyed it. My first Keaton I'd seen at all. And also, I watched some trash when I was off my head. Joe Rogan's comedy special, Strange Times. I watched the entire of that.
Wow.
One of the worst pieces of comedy. I mean, I know it's not a film, so I shouldn't really be talking about it, but I just wanted to add it into someone's letterbox. One of the worst comedy specials I've ever seen in my life. I think I sat through the entire thing without a smirk. My word, that was poor. I rewatched Borat recently, which is very good. I actually love Borat. I think that, you know, I don't know. I just feel like it perhaps doesn't receive the critical praise it actually deserves. I think Borat is a marvelous film. I would not say that it's aged poorly, but I think a lot of people would. And I also watched the 2007 film Epic Movie, which does suck ass, but is very enjoyable.
I love that film in a horrible way.
Epic movie. Yeah. The whole time I was watching it, I was like, I know this is poor, but I really, really enjoy this. I actually love this.
Yeah.
But I think I might have just been too drunk to really think straight. Okay. Take it away, Lewis.
I've watched more, so I'll speed through it because there are a few things that I want to actually talk about. I watched Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. It's nominated for an Oscar, so I'll just quickly say it's very good. It's very, very good. It's beautifully animated. The voice acting is great. The story is great. It's really fantastic. I also watched Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, also nominated for an Oscar, and it is great, as you would expect. However, shockingly, if I were an Oscar voter, I would be voting for Puss in Boots over Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. I watched Women Talking, which maybe we'll talk about in the future. I watched Saint Omer, which is a great film. It's one of the moments in it really was fabulous. It's about a mother who murders her child, and it's a journalist following the trial. And at one point, it's about the journalist's relationship with her mother. And at one point, the journalist says to her partner, "I'm worried that I'll end up like her." And then she says, "My mother." And it's like, she's more worried about ending up like her mother rather than this woman who's murdered her child. It's a really great film. It's really great. I watched Magic Mike's Last Dance, which was okay. I watched Sleepless in Seattle, classic rom-com. Loved it. Great. Titanic on the big screen. Yeah, it was my first watch. I'd never seen it before, and it was great. Titanic on the big screen, the IMAX 3D 4K high frame rate remaster of Titanic. It was epic. When people talk about epic films, nothing compares to Titanic. It's incredible. I watched Marcel Michel.
Oh, we get it. You love James fucking Cameron.
I do love James Cameron. He's great. I watched Marcel Michel. Yeah, but don't you agree?
Sorry, can we talk about Titanic for a second? Do you not agree? Right, that regardless of your thoughts on Titanic, and we've talked about this, I think, on the podcast briefly before, and my opinions of Titanic are not especially high. Do you not think that the beginning and end roses and old woman stuff is completely pointless?
No.
Really?
No, that's great. The
opening. Do you feel like the film does not lose anything by just telling it through? We don't need to be linked to the future.
No, we don't need to, but it helps. It's great. I mean, the opening scene, I saw someone talking about this, I can't remember where. Like, they sit down with the old Rose and they talk about how the ship sank. And then you see that play out in real time. And it makes sense in your head when you're watching it, because you got an in-depth explanation of it at the start. And it wouldn't work without that. It wouldn't work without that. It's incredible.
I'm currently 3/4 of the way through Mark Kermode's book from, I think, like 2013, called The Good, the Bad, and the Multiplex. And he goes into quite a lot of depth about Titanic. And he talks about how, it's Paramount, wasn't it? And he talks about how he went to the some dinner or something, and he was talking to the head of Paramount at the time, and he basically just listed to her all the reasons why Titanic sucks, one after another after another. You know, this doesn't make sense, this is stupid, this is done so much better in Night to Remember, because he keeps comparing it to that. He lists all these reasons why Titanic sucks, and then she's just kind of politely nodding, and she goes, "I think the problem here is, Mark, is that you're not a 16-year-old girl."
That is a great response.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's true. But it is great. Titanic is great. It's really, really good.
Formerly the most successful film of all time.
Yes, it is. I watched Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which was great. I watched Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, which wasn't great. I watched...
That's a surprise. I think we are going to review that on the podcast, by the way.
At some point, yes. A groundbreaking review to come. I watched Cocaine Bear, which, you know, it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's about a bear.
Also going to be done on the podcast.
Yes. Also.
Yes. We're doing so I'm going to say this on record to try and pressure us into doing it. But in the next, I'm going to say 6 months, I would like to do a return to popular cinema episode where we do Creed 3, Cocaine Bear, and Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
Yes, we will do that.
So, again, delaying this, going on, waffling again. Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, right? You saw it. I haven't seen it yet. I don't really want to see it, but I do horrible things to this podcast, like watch all 9 Fast and Furious films. Anyway.
Yeah.
Quantumania, which isn't a word, right?
Yeah.
Contains the word Ant-Man in it.
It does.
Right? They didn't use that for any promotional material.
They didn't. They do at the end of the film.
Oh, do they? I was going to say, did they? Part of me thought, did they not even realise this?
I know. I feel like they didn't realise it until it was too late.
Yeah, it's also because a really shit title.
I quite like it.
I don't know. It doesn't really title's mean anything, better than the does film.
It? It does. It's Quantumania. I mean,
I don't know. I haven't seen Ant-Man and the Wasp, but I'm not going to judge it before I was going to see it. I was going to say a very rude comment about Ant-Man and the Wasp, but I'm sure it's amazing. I'm sure it'll be talking about it this time next year for the next for Oscars.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, for best MODOK.
Best MODOK.
Best MODOK goes to...
Yes.
The MODOK Disney Plus series, which is actually really good, guys. Go watch that.
Yes. I also watched all of the Creed films, which we'll talk about if and when we do Creed 3. I watched John Wick 1, which was good. And then the films that I want to talk about a little bit in detail, but quickly. I don't want to talk about this in detail, but I watched Mulholland Drive. It was amazing. Very, very good. My local picture house had a Weimar cinema season.
I also watched Metropolis.
Ooh, work. I watched It started with The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which it basically the same thing about what you said about Godzilla. It was difficult to say I enjoyed it. It felt like I was watching it to learn something almost. Like I respected it. But it's not really the type of film that a modern audience would say, yes, that was amazing, I enjoyed it so much. Although the production design is insane.
Amazing.
It's really incredible production design.
Yeah.
Amazing, beautiful sets.
The first time I watched The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, I agree, I had the same thoughts. But when I've watched it since, I have come to actually really enjoy it as a film.
Ooh, maybe I'll enjoy it on a rewatch then. The next film in this Weimar season at Picture House was The Blue Angel from 1930. It was the first ever German talkie. And I didn't really enjoy this one that much. It was a bit boring, I want to say. Again, I respect what it was doing. It gave us Marlene Dietrich, which is great. But one thing I will say about it is it's really fascinating because this is the first film I've ever seen where you can really tell that this was during the transition between silent and speaking, like talkies. The way that they use sound, it's almost like it's a gimmick. Like, oh, look, we've got sound. And the performances as well, particularly the lead, Emile Jannings, who was a silent movie star, his performance is so over the top and animated and exaggerated because he's not used to being able to use his voice to act. So the way he moves, the way his facial expressions, that is very exaggerated. It's very, very over the top and cartoonish because he's used to having to do over the top body acting to express his emotions. But it wasn't that great outside of that. To be honest, I wasn't a huge fan. The next film in that season was Metropolis, the big one.
Let's go.
The big one. The first ever sci-fi film, as many say. Seeing it on the... I had seen it before. Seeing it on the big screen, it was great. It was so good. It's amazing.
Yes.
It's
as
so...
it often reminds you, the mediator between the head and the hands is the quantum realm.
The quantum Metropolis Quantumania.
Metropolis Quantumania, yeah.
But no, Metropolis is great. It's incredible. And it also, not only was it a very good film, like everything about it technically is fabulous, but it's crazy how this period in German history, the Weimar period before Hitler arrived, after World War One, before Hitler, it's crazy how socially liberal and like...
I've always known
that about the Germany in the 20s and very, very early 30s. But this film was like, it's a working class revolution, basically, about capitalism is bad and about how rich people hoard everything. And I was like, this is crazy that this came from, you know, 6 years after this came out. It was the Third Reich. Hitler was... in Germany. Apparently, one of Hitler's favourite films, which is weird.
Which is very ironic.
I also read about... this film, quickly before you ask me this, I also read about this film. Joseph Goebbels, the Minister for Propaganda of Nazi Germany, loved this yes. film so much that he rang Fritz Lang in 1933 and said, you are an honorary Aryan. Fritz Lang has Jewish heritage. And he said, regardless of your Jewish heritage, I love your film so much. You're an honorary Aryan. And I'd like to offer you a job as the head of Germany's film industry. And that night, Fritz Lang sold all of his wife's jewelry. His wife was a Nazi sympathizer and fled Germany. And after 4 months, never went back.
Wow. Big up.
Which is a crazy, crazy move. Like that very night. The reason he sold all his wife's jewelry was because the banks were closed because Joseph Goebbels rang him at night. So he sold his wife's jewelry, got on a train to Paris, and never went back.
Crazy. Who do you think's winning honorary Aryan at the Oscars this year?
Oh, God.
do you think the lead in Metropolis, I believe he's titled Freda Fredersen, do you think he looks a bit like Den from The Room?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. It takes a while to get into it, doesn't it, Metropolis? Like, yeah, I watched it again recently, and it does take... Like, the beginning, I think, is called the prelude, which is like an hour and 15 minutes long. Yeah. Not much happens.
Yeah, it's a very slow burn. It's really long. I was surprised at how long it is.
Yeah,
it's
like two and a half hours.
2 hours. I was surprised.
Thanks to the... the remaining scenes being found in Buenos Aires in like 2012.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah. Wonderful film.
It is, it's fabulous. The next film in this Weimar season was M, Fritz Lang's M, which was from 1931, and it was Fritz Lang's first talkie. And it's amazing. It's really fabulous. It's insane that this is his first talkie. Like I was saying a second ago about how The Blue Angel... It feels like a silent film, but with sound. This feels very modern. This feels like it could be a Hitchcock thriller from the 60s. It's impressively modern. It's fabulous writing. The like social commentary about it is very modern as well. Again, going back to what I just said about Metropolis, it's a very modern ideas in the film about children and child abuse and predators as well. It's really, really good. Fritz Lang said it was his magnum opus, and I kind of agree. It's really good. The last things that I want to talk about, I want to talk about as an entity, and I would like to have a bit of an open discussion about this, because if you are an avid listener of the Now Showing podcast, you will know that I hate horror films. I don't watch horror films. And one particular horror film traumatized me when I was a child, and it was Scream. And Ghostface, the mask, I used to have breakdowns whenever I saw it when I was a kid. And I watched Scream. I've seen all of the Scream films now. All of them, including Scream 6.
I haven't seen Scream 6, but I have seen the first five.
Yeah. And I love Scream. It's so good.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Especially the first one. The first one is a masterpiece. Absolutely perfect. No notes. It kind of drops off. It never quite gets as good as the first one. But I still love Scream 2. I still love Scream 3. Scream 4 was great, but my least favourite. Scream 5 and Scream 6 are, you know, maybe we'll talk about them in the future. You haven't seen Scream 6, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But the one thing I will say about Scream, and particularly Scream 1, 2 and 3, is I've always thought that Scream was like a campy, over-the-top, funny slasher film. I didn't realize. I was shocked at how technically impressive they are. They're really fucking good. They're really well done. The cinematography is amazing. The way that like Ghostface lunges and swoops around with his knife, the camera kind of follows him and does these weird swoops and weird like lunges around the room when he's running, chasing someone around. It's so good. It's so well edited. It's so well thought out. In Scream 3, there's one scene where a woman's walking down a hallway and it's a close-up of her feet and her feet are wet. And I remember seeing it and thinking, why are we seeing her feet? Why? We don't need to see her feet. We don't need feet shots in this film. And then 5 minutes later, she's being chased by Ghostface and she slips.
Kink-shaming Lewis Royal.
I'm not kink-shaming, I'm just kink-disappointed. But like five minutes later, she slips. And I was like, That's why we had the close-up of the feet. So we knew her feet were wet, and now it makes sense that she slips. And there are so many
like when Sharon
like
Tate
that.
Slips in at the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, obviously. But there are so many moments like that that are just so well thought out. And so just it's so good. Like the Metacot is a very meta franchise, obviously. It never quite gets as good as the jokes in the first one. Like it very much makes sense in the first one. After the first one, it gradually gets more and more like shoehorned in the meta-ness of it. But in the first one, it's absolutely perfect. No notes. It's incredible.
Yeah. I think this almost feels. You know, the way that I think the best Matrix film is the fourth one, right? And that's like the one that's all self-referential and it's all about the Matrix. In the same way that I think Rocky Balboa is arguably the best Rocky film. It feels weird to say that I think Scream is the best slasher ever made. Because it feels weird because it's kind of based on how good slashers are. And it's all about the kind of the greats. But I've seen the big ones. I've seen, you know, Texas Chainsaw and Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. I think Scream, the first Scream, I think is the best slasher that I've ever seen.
I mean, I haven't seen many, if any, but yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, Scream 1 is excellent. I also noticed there, you and me share an unpopular opinion. It's actually really boring. Why do we, of all the people to have a podcast together, two people that share all of the same opinions? By the way, I'm certain we'll probably have the exact same opinions on all of these films we're reading today. But anyway, we share a very similar opinion, which is that Scream 4 is the worst one.
Yes, I did not know that was unpopular until I spoke to people about it, and they were like, no, not Scream 4.
And Scream 4 is definitely the worst one.
Yeah, it feels... It's weird, because it's obviously so Scream timely. Is from 96, Scream 2 is from 97, yeah. Scream 3 is from 2000, Scream 4 jumps, like, 10-year break, 2011, and yet that one feels the most dated. That one feels
100%.
The most
I completely
stuck in
agree.
Its time. Like, Scream 1 is a 90s movie. It feels very 90s, but it works. 2011, Scream 4... That it doesn't feel like it's real. It uses technology that's very 2011, but also nobody actually had that. Like, it's just a weird space between working and not working. It feels so dated, and it looks weird. It's got a weird filter on it. It looks like the contrast was turned up to 100%. It was I still liked it, but it was my least favorite one.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Scream is going to deliver on a certain amount. Like, it's going to, if it's a Scream film, it's going to tick a few boxes.
Yeah, definitely. But my ranking of Scream,
excludes
I won't
six.
Include,
you can,
yeah, I was just going to say I won't include six.
You can include five, though.
Yeah, my ranking at the moment is Scream 1, Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 5, Scream 4.
Oh, really? Mine is pretty similar. Mine is Scream, then Scream 5, then 2, then 3, then 4.
Ooh,
I like I really like Scream 5. Yeah, 5. I thought 5 was great.
I've liked all of them. You know, Scream 4 is my least favorite one. I still really liked it. So yeah, it's weird that I've seen Scream now. It's weird.
Yeah, well done.
I
mate.
Went on a binge.
I mean, I'm not saying well Scream. Done because they're not scary outside
yeah,
like
they're
two
not. They're not. When I was watching the original, I was shocked at how not scary it was.
And that's probably the scariest one.
Yeah. I watch. Well, actually, I disagree. I think 5 is scarier.
All right, fair enough.
But yeah, I watched Scream 1 on the 5th of March, and then I watched Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 4, Scream 5, and Scream 6 in one day. And I watched Scream 5
watched
and 6
all
in
the Scream films in one day.
Did you?
Yeah, I think I watched Scream 1, 2, 3, 4 in a night. And then I fell asleep, and then as soon as I woke up, went to the cinema to watch 5.
Ooh, nice. I finished Scream 4 and then left to go and watch Scream 5 and 6. They did a double bill. And I was very nervous because I was like, I've handled the Scream films at home. Don't know how I'm going to cope in the cinema. But
we are 35 minutes into the podcast, and we haven't gone to the news yet.
We haven't. There isn't much news, so it's okay. But the one thing I will say about seeing Scream in the cinema, and we can end on this, is I'm very timid. I don't like scary films. We've discussed this many times. I was shocked at the reactions of people in the cinema. People were like going, huh! And like when something gory would happen, people would be like, oh, oh. And I was fine with it. And I'm like, maybe I'm not timid. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I should branch out.
You are timid, yeah. No, you are. I hate to break it to you. Those people were probably just having fun.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, the news.
Is it about the DCEU this week? Because we usually seem to be about the DCEU. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Only a little bit, though. So the first bit of news we have is that there was a new Flash trailer, which isn't really news, but it happened. There's Batman stuff in it. Michael Keaton's Batman is back.
Yeah, we already knew that, though.
Yeah, but we've seen
it. It looks a bit weird. Now. Yeah, but the face-on shot of him looks really funny.
He does, yeah. But the thing, I think a lot of people are complaining about how weird it looks. And I think that's because the Burton Batman movies were so stylized that when you put it in a normal-looking universe, it doesn't look right.
Yeah, you're probably right, yeah.
Yeah.
Talking of DCEU trailers, and I obviously would love to talk about the DCEU more. have you seen the trailer for Shazam 2?
Yes, I have.
Does that not look like the worst thing you've ever seen?
It looks fine, you know?
every single time the trailer comes on, my brain goes, this is a mobile game. And then I realised halfway through that it's Shazam.
I just threw a truck at a dragon.
Yeah, man. I don't know about that. Apparently, there's a DCU film called Blue Beetle coming out. Did anyone know about this? Yeah.
When is it coming out?
I think like this year.
Is it?
Or maybe next year.
I've never heard of it.
It's coming out a lot. Yeah, it's coming out relatively soon.
Oh, wow.
It's coming out like at least like 2 years before Blade ever does.
That's true.
I feel like there's been like a load of Fantastic Four and Blade have been like announced like 4 years ago, and we've still not got them. Nowhere near coming out.
Yeah, we don't know anything about Fantastic Four yet.
I think it comes out in 2025, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're aiming for, but who knows?
I heard that Marvel are trying to pace out their shit more.
I agree. I've heard the same thing, and I think it's a Bob Iger thing. Now Iger's back.
Yes.
I think...
Great decision.
Yes. Although I don't necessarily think Iger has said slow stuff down. I think Chapek was saying speed stuff up. And now they've just gone back to what they wanted to do in the first place.
Because I really don't think that I would be so anti-Marvel if I was just... If I just got, like, a bit of content here and there. I think, for me, it's all fatigue. How the fuck am I supposed to keep up with, like, all these shows?
Yeah, 3 movies a year was perfect. I used to love that.
Even that seems a little much, right?
I mean, I'd take 1 movie
a year. 3 movies a year. Yeah, 2 movies a year sounds right. But like, you think about a normal film.
Yeah, that's
true. Like, when Star Wars comes out, you don't get 3 Star Warses in a year, do you? You get 1 every 2 years, whatever, 1 a year.
Yeah, that's true. But I remember when it was two or three movies a year, and I remember loving it and being like, oh my God, give us more. And then they gave us more, and I was like, no, stop.
Yeah, stop giving us more, yeah.
Yeah. Some not DC-related news. Avatar 2 has become the second / third highest grossing film of all time. It became the second...
Do we also not do this... On every single news
we
section.
Have done for a while, yes. Avatar 2 became the second highest grossing film of all time, beating Titanic. Then Titanic was re-released, and Titanic became the second highest grossing film of all time. I don't have the current stats, but I assume Titanic is number 2 and Avatar 2 is number 3. But I don't know.
Wait, so what's Endgame? 4?
Endgame. Oh no, Endgame is 2. I apologise, I've messed that up. They're fighting for the third spot. No, are they?
Okay, we're not re-recording this, by the way. You're just having to look like an idiot.
I just don't remember what it is. Avatar 1 is Endgame is 2. Oh, yeah, they're fighting for the third spot. They become the third / fourth highest grossing film of all time.
That's decent. Okay. I hope Avatar 2 wins because it's a far better film than Titanic.
I would love either way. Don't really care. Get Out has joined the 2 million watched club on Letterboxd. How cool for Get Out.
What an absolutely exceptional film.
It is a great film. Deserves to be in the 2 million watched club.
Alison Williams, that's her name, right?
I think so.
Why is she not in more films?
She was in Megan.
She was in Megan, that is true. Well, get her in. Why is she not a superhero yet?
I mean, you could say that she plays a superhero in Megan.
Yeah. Why is she not in Dune Part 2?
She might be in Dune 3, Dune Messiah.
Yeah. Also hear that this is I've got a bit of news for you. The Ooh, Dune work. Sisterhood spin-off like lost its director and producer and shit, and it's like getting delayed.
Its main star.
Yeah, something like that. It's getting delayed.
That sounds
I don't really know the news. Like, I've kind of just like read it on the back of someone else's newspaper. I don't really know what happened, but I know it's not coming out soon.
Yeah, that seems like it's in production hell. Some sad news. They are making a live action adaptation of the How to Train Your Dragon.
that was good. I actually fully expected a celebrity death there.
And it's directed by the same guy who directed the animated films.
Why are they doing that?
Don't know.
That's of all of the animated films to make, that seems like one of the stupidest things to do.
Yeah, very weird, very weird.
Why would they do that?
I have no idea, because they love money.
In some much more positive news,
Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon has a rumoured runtime of 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Oh, whoa.
Which sounds great to me. Sign me up.
Yeah, a rumoured second screenshot of that film. Production photo, whatever.
One more production still.
Yeah, one more production still. Except it was just that one with him with the curtains.
Yeah. In some sad news, actual sad news, of course, Ray Liotta died last year. I was going to say,
fucking hell, we covered that one a while ago.
He died quite a while ago, and he has received a posthumous star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which is very deserved.
Cool. Do you think it's due to his role in Cocaine Bear, or...?
I'd like to think so. I mean, he wasn't in Cocaine Bear. He didn't have a star. He stars in Cocaine Bear. He gets a star.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds suspicious.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of animation, Guillermo del Toro's next project is a stop-motion adaptation of The Buried Giant, and it will be developed for Netflix. The story apparently follows an elderly couple living in a fictional post-Arthurian England in which no one is able to retain long-term memories.
I feel like you did those news sections in the wrong order, because we weren't talking about animation, we were talking about Ray Liotta.
That's true, but, you know, I wrote these down as I see them, not as I think they should be announced.
Speaking of animation...
Speaking of money grabs, Warner Brothers have announced they are making a new Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, yeah. So when you read that sentence, you shit yourself, right? Like, why are they making more Lord of the Rings films? But it isn't as bad as it sounds. They're making more films in the universe. They're not remaking Lord of the Rings.
That's true. But still,
Which is fine. Look, a lot of people hated Rings of Power. A lot of people actually love Rings of Power. I think that they're making more... Tolkien's universe is enormous. Even though it's quite a small amount of works, right? It's only, five or six books, because, you know, I'm including the ones that his son has helped write. Yeah. You know, you've just kind of got the Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, Fall of Numenor, you know... Etc. Etc. There's five or six books, but there's the appendices, the lore. It's so written out. All the notes that Tolkien wrote. Like, there is so much more to do in that world without even starting to write your own stuff. So I think that as long as you have a semi-decent team, I think you can get at least Hobbit quality films out of the rest of his work.
I just can't see it ending well, but I hope it does.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're probably right. Sorry, I'm being too glass half full there.
No, it's fine. We need a little optimism to counteract my pessimism. Everything Everywhere All at Once has made history. It won the most SAG awards of all time.
Do you think that doesn't sound... Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. Do you not feel like that's like an episode two kind of... Part well, two kind
maybe.
Of.
Maybe, yeah, that's true. I didn't pretend I didn't say that. Some more DCEU news. I forgot about this bit.
For fuck's sake. You're joking.
No, I'm not. I forgot about this. This is actually quite cool, though. This is quite cool. Ben Affleck may be directing the DC's Brave and the Bold, which is a Batman film about Batman and Robin.
That's cool. That is cool.
Yeah. Final bit of news I have, which is hilarious, by the way. A few months ago, a few years ago now, Patty Jenkins had a Star Wars film announced. A few months ago, it was announced that it had been removed from Lucasfilm's slate. A few weeks ago, it was announced that that film is not being removed from Lucasfilm's slate. It is still happening. It is now being removed from Lucasfilm's slate again.
Oh, my fucking God.
Yeah.
Talking the DCEU, the back and forthing on that one, my word.
It's really
DC
funny.
Move that.
It's really funny.
Oh, my word.
It's been shelved indefinitely.
Poor Patty Jenkins.
I know. She deserves better than this. Wonder Woman was great.
I mean, she doesn't, does she? Have you seen the Wonder Woman films?
Wonder Woman 1 was great.
Wonder Woman 1 was mediocre.
Wonder Woman 1 was great. Wonder Woman 2 had its
Wonder
moments.
Wonder Woman 2 sucks ass.
No, I enjoyed Wonder Woman 2.
Matt, to be fair, I think I gave it like a 7 on the podcast.
Yeah. And maybe Rogue Squadron, when or if it comes out.
Cool name.
It is a cool name. It's, you know,
Rogue Squadron Quantumania.
Rogue Squadron is to Lucasfilm what the Doctor Who episode is to the Now Showing podcast.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon.
It's been shelved again. It's fabulous.
Oh, my word. That's no way we're doing three Oscars episodes before we're doing the Doctor Who episode. We announced the Doctor Who episode, I think, like last Oscars.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah. Wowie. Okay, is that all the news?
That is all the news, as far as I'm aware.
That means we actually have to do our job.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no. We'll save that for episode two. Go on.
Okay. Let's review some films, shall we? Eh?
Let's review three films.
Three films. Okay. We're going to be starting off with All Quiet on the Western Front. Yeah?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All Quiet on the Western Front is a film directed by Edward Berger, written by Edward Berger, Ian Stokel and Leslie Patterson, adaptation of the 1929 novel, and stars Felix Kramer. Sorry, that was an awful, awful pronunciation. And this next one's not going to be any better, but that it's not even close. Felix Kramer, I believe, in the lead role, and also features a performance from Daniel Brühl, who will be known to English-speaking audiences due to his role in the Marvel films. All Quiet on the Western Front, of course, relevant in the Oscars nomination, Oscars conversation, not only because it got nominated for a large number of Oscars, but also because it is another adaptation of a film which had already won Best Picture, so that would make history if it were to do so, to replicate that feat and win Best Picture as well. That was a bit waffly, but I think you know what I meant. All Quiet on the Western Front is the story of a soldier named Paul, who's played by Felix Kramer, and it's kind of just going through his experience in the First World War, in the last few years of the war, and with, you know, going in with his friends and witnessing the brutality of trench warfare and the reality of losing friends in those environments. And also features a secondary storyline about the political ongoings amongst the upper classes in the war, as Daniel Brühl and a number of other German dignitaries try and force an armistice with the French government, obviously ending up in the Treaty of Versailles. So, what did you think of All Quiet on the Western Front, Lewis?
All Quiet on the Western Front. I saw it in the cinema, saw it on the big screen, and yeah, it's a war film.
It is a war film.
It is, and that's it really. It's a war film. I've seen it before. It's the same as every other war film. There are trench scenes. There are frontline scenes. There are no man's land scenes. There are scenes where spirits are lifted and then quickly get shot down again. There are gas mask scenes. There are things that happen in every single war film ever. And nothing new. There is no new ground being broken by this. It's a war film. It's a, you know,
I mean, it is literally a remake.
It's well made. It's well made. But it's, you know, I think we as a society have progressed past the need for frontline war films. We don't need any more. They're not really doing anything. I haven't seen one in a very long time that does anything different, apart from 1917, which the only thing it did different was the one take. Other than that, it's exactly the same as this. It's about a group of people who have to get from A to B, and there's a war in between, and they fight in that war, and some of them die, and some of them don't die. And yeah, that's it. It's a war film, the same as every other war film ever made. We don't need any more.
It is nice. It's okay. Nice.
It's well
nice
made.
Stuff, guys.
It's well made.
No, I just, I'd already, I don't know your feelings on all, any of the three films, really, but I was under the impression that we probably would have the same opinion on all three, and I'm happy that we differ.
Oh, good.
At least on this. Because I really liked All Quiet on the Western Front. I definitely understand what you're saying. I'm not going to beat around the bush. Like, there are obviously a lot of very typical cliches and things that are done in every single war film. And I guess you can reorder things and you can end up making a different already watched war film by chopping some scenes up. But I found it, of course, it's not going to be original because it is a remake and it is an adaptation of a very famous book. But I think the way it did it, I think, you know, we're talking about, you, as you said, technically excellent, right? Were you talking about absolutely utilizing the very much best of our current capabilities to show the same things we've seen before, but in a much higher quality? It looked wonderful. The sound was wonderful. You know, the whole experience, you really, the production design, everything like that. Again, you know, we've seen this story before, but maybe not so high quality. But what I love the most, you know, I can talk about the acting, I can talk about the score, I can talk about a lot of things that I think are really good about this film. But I think, I believe this is not in the book. I believe this, I don't know if it's in the original film. I know it's not in the book. What I really enjoyed about All Quiet on the Western Front was the dual narrative of the kind of upper class, you know, war leaders compared to the kind of the lower class soldiers. I'm sure it has been done before, but I think on this kind of scale of popularity, and especially in First World War, I think it was a really interesting to see the kind of juxtaposition between, you know, we talk about people starving, you know, shots of, you know, people eating turnip bread for every single meal, and then we're shown minutes later at a German the French dignitaries complaining that the you know their pastries were not fresh, you know, and I think as well the sense of time, I think, is done really, really well here. That you know they discuss, and spoilers, you know, World War One ended, and when they're discussing ending World War One and the armistice, and they're discussing the retreat of Versailles, Daniel Brühl's character objects to the concept that, you know, that they're going to end it at a certain time. Oh, no, actually, sorry, I'm misremembering. He objects to the idea that they have 72 hours to reach a decision about the ending of the war, because in his eyes, and quite rightfully so, 72 hours is a very long time for people to die in. Because when he first said, you know, you have 72 hours to decide whether the war ends, in my mind, that doesn't sound like very long at all. 72 hours to decide whether the entire First World War ends, you know, that's nothing. But then when he says it, you know, someone's dying every minute, and then you're seeing people die, I mean, you're seeing no man's land, you're seeing the violence, you're presenting it, you're not discussing it, you're shown, you know, and through a sympathetic character that you know in Paul, you're seeing the human level, whilst kind of realizing the scale of it and discussing that, you know, that every single minute mattered. That I thought that was that really built the sense of time up more than even 1917, which is shot essentially in real time. I thought that was done really well. Again, I think the leading performance from Felix Kramer, is wonderful. I think he shows a wonderful display of emotions. You know, the real kind of feeling of being, you know, PTSD, but traumatized by war, looking at him early on in the film, youthful, you know, vibrant to the end, you know, just being kind of, especially, you know, in the trenches themselves, kind of a shell of himself. Yeah, okay, I agree with you. There's something that war films do, especially films that involve no man's land. So, you know, 1917, War Horse, you know, so on and so forth. I hate the thing where you have this invincible protagonist storming through no man's land. Everyone around them dying, all of their friends, everyone that you've known, they all get killed. And it's really emotional thing. But they are just running, you know, full pelt and never taking any serious damage. These invincible protagonists in war films do annoy me. I think 1917 does subvert that trope to a degree. But, you know, early on, but yeah, it did annoy me a bit more. It's like, oh god, this is so unrealistic. Like, this guy is, why is he not dead here? You know, but yeah, I think, you know, and some really, really powerful emotional beats, especially late on. You know, I think there's two very emotional scenes towards the end involving two important characters dying. The one scene in the woods, one scene in the bunker, in the trench. Those two scenes really both did leave a hole in my heart. Yeah. So, All Quiet on the Western Front, perhaps unoriginal, as you say, but I think this is maybe the one of the best adaptations or best versions of that particular trope, of those particular cliches, whatever, of all these wartime, you know, things that we expect in every film. I don't think any film has necessarily done it as well as this. So for me, you know, this year has been exceptional for all films. And the Best Picture lineup is absolutely stacked. But I'll be very happy to see this win. I think it's a wonderful film.
It's like technically very good, but if you know everything in it I've seen in different war films done better or the same, you know, Saving Private Ryan, Dunkirk, everything, you know, every war film ever is the same. There are trenchy scenes, there are gratuitous deaths where people get squashed by tanks or blown up by grenades. It's it's nothing that you haven't seen before.
I think this is a lot more personal, you know. Even though we do have,
I think Private Ryan is far more personal.
I don't think I'd agree myself. But I think that even though we do have those cutaway scenes, which I think really do make the film, when we're in the trenches, we are always with Paul, And he doesn't really say too much. He's not really like a very, you know, outward, passionate, you know, very loud character. But I think just through, again, I think a wonderful performance, facial expressions and such, you really start to sympathize, empathize, kind of live through Paul. And I think that you kind of get a more of a kind of point of view perspective of what the First World War was like. I mean, especially the scene on the tank shop, I think that there was like, that caused almost real fear in me that you wouldn't usually associate with tanks showing up in a war film. But I think because you realize the kind of the size and the kind of dauntingness of it, because you're so linked to Paul, I think it makes everything a little bit more scary. A little bit more real.
I don't get it, personally. I'm not a fan of war films at all. I don't need any more war films. If there's one, I'd be bored.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very technically impressive. Cinematography's yes. great, editing's great, makeup's great, production design's great, but it's no better than in any other war film I've seen, so there's no point in this. You know, war films have nothing new to say. They've been making war films for as long as cinema has been around. Nothing new can be done with them, unless you make it a comedy, like Jojo Rabbit, or something completely different, like Inglourious Basterds. Unless you, and if you're telling a frontline, no man's land, trenches war story, there is no new ground to tread. It's all been done. There's no point. War is bad for everyone. We get it. It's bad for the bad guys. It's bad for the good guys. It's all, you know, the aristocrats and the politicians. They're the ones to blame. We get it. Every war film ever has said that. We don't need more. Stop, please. We don't need more war films.
I don't agree at all. Also, nice to have a mainstream film from the Germans' perspective in World War One. Once.
Yeah, that was interesting, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's not like goodies and baddies like World War II, because you know, World War II, I'm unlike perhaps my Spotify number one artist, I would personally be happy to say that I think the Nazis are bad and Hitler was a bad dude. I'm happy to say that.
Yeah, it'd be difficult to sympathize with the Nazis.
Yes. Again, slightly wish my favorite musicians share that same sentiment.
Proud to say he was not on my Spotify Wrapped.
Yeah. Of course, I'm talking about Epic Rap Battles of History. Yes, as well as Hitler was a bad dude and the Nazis were bad, World War One, it's all just politics at that point. World War One, there's not really a good guy or a bad guy at all, really. But it's all told through the victors. So we all absorb only British and American content in regards to the First World War. So seeing it from the very miserable, very depressing losing days of World War One in Germany. I mean, I know what you mean. I know what you mean, but I think it's slightly disingenuous to pretend that the time frame, the narrative, the events that happen don't directly affect how different a film is. Like, this film has not been done before. I mean, it has been done before. This is literally a remake. But this story has not been done before in a million other war films, because it's quite a unique story. It's just perhaps going to... Yes,
it's
is.
Friends in the war, fighting in the war. That's what Saving Private
Ryan is. Yeah, on a basic level. But yeah,
what more is there to it? It's a group of friends.
I'm just saying, the events that happen within the war, which shape the narrative, affect the. It's not going to be the same having a film like Dunkirk, which is in World War II and is all about naval warfare, is not, and about the invasion of Dunkirk, is not going to be the same about a film that set the dying days of World War One. Nor is it going to be the same as a film set in any other part of any other war. It's not going to be the same as fucking Full Metal Jacket. You know what I mean? Like, the narrative, the importance of the events. Right. Do you count Full Metal Jacket in that as well? Which
I
feels very different.
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're going to complain about frontline war films, that does feel very different.
I haven't seen that one. Full disclaimer. But but yeah. I mean, what narrative moments, what things happen? People get blown up. People get blown up and gets traumatized by it.
Yeah, but you're obviously dumbing it down. Like, I'm talking about the fight.
What more is there? You see a stranger who you never met, you don't know their name, you've never seen them before. He gets run over by a tank and his body explodes like a water balloon. What more is there to that?
I'm talking about the actual events that happen in the film. Not like about, what? Like, just individual scenes and shit. I'm talking about, like, when they start the warfare, when they're losing the war and they have to retreat, like, all their thousands of troops and shit. And then when I don't want to spoil the ending, when their mad general decides to let them out with fucking, like, 20 minutes to go and they have to fucking do that fucking mad surprise attack with 20 minutes to go before the end of the war. These things are not going to happen in any other film that isn't set in the last 20 minutes of World War One on the German side in that particular battle.
Well, that ending was fairly interesting.
Yeah,
I would have much preferred a film about the last hour.
Right, well done. It's called All Quiet on the Western Front. It's available on Netflix now.
It's not, though. It's over, like, a year.
Yes, but the main section of the film is over the last 5 days of the war.
There's no new ground being stepped on here.
Yeah, because it's a remake. Last
5 minutes. I've not seen. I'm not even talking about the original All Quiet on the Western Front. I haven't seen it.
Okay, I'm going to give this film a 9 out of 10.
Wow.
Oh, no, I'm actually going to give it an 8.5.
I mean, if I'd never seen another war film,
oh, God.
It's like a 10 out of 10. But I have
I'm going to give it an 8.5.
If I hadn't seen any other war films, it's a 10 out of 10, but I have. So it's like a, what, like a, I don't even know what to give it, because it is very technically impressive, but I just don't care about it. So I guess like a 5, a 6.
You suck. Okay.
At least we disagree.
Yeah, at least we disagree. Yeah, okay. My man the match is going to go... God, I don't know. Do you know who you're giving man the match while I quickly scroll through and try and find a name?
Yeah, I guess I will give my man a match to James Friend, the cinematographer. It's well shot.
Yeah, Yeah, he is very, very well shot. Yeah, I am going to also do that, actually. It's very well shot. I'm also going to give it to James Friend.
Great. We agree on something. Stuff.
I always give it to cinematographers every fucking time.
You do.
Let's agree on a film, shall we? I actually don't know if we will agree, but part of me thinks we will, based on our film tastes. Let's talk about Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. Let's talk about Tar.
Quantumania.
Let's talk about the documentary Tar.
Yes, the biopic.
The biopic. Of course, not a biopic. Written and directed by Todd Field. Tar is the story of Lydia Tar, played by Kate Blanchett, who is a conductor who is accused of a number of, well, mainly of sexual abuse and driving someone to suicide. Whilst she tries to complete her kind of shining magnum opus, as a phrase previously said in the podcast, her magnum opus, her shining star, her kind of zenith of her career. She's dealing with these allegations. Stars obviously Kate Blanchett, but also Nina Hoss, Naomi Merlant, and a Mark Strong in a wig.
A very, very convincing wig.
A very, very convincing wig. This is nominated for a number of Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, Best Actress, Best Cinematography, and Best Editing. Kate Blanchett has won the BAFTA for Best Actress. So, talk to me about Tar. Talk to me about Kate Blanchett.
Am I going first again?
Yeah, you kind of pissed me off on the last one, so I might make you go first on all three.
Fair enough. Well, Tar...
It's my podcast, bitch.
Tar. Tar. What a picture. I loved Tar. I loved Tar so much. It's so, so good. It's incredible. Everything about it is flawless, and I can't think of anything wrong with it. Cate Blanchett's performance, yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible. The direction is unbelievable. The writing is insane. Cinematography is fabulous. Same cinematographer who did the classic Johnny Depp film Mordecai. Interestingly yes. enough, the editing is fabulous. The acting is fabulous. It's fabulous. It's the type of masterpiece that comes along once every few years. This is a genuinely interesting, thought-provoking film. A film that it doesn't tell you how to feel about what's happening. It just presents the events to you and wants you to go away and think about it and make your own mind up about the things that happen, what it means. You know, I saw a lot of people saying that this was slow, and I expected it to be a very slow, artsy, pretentious film. And I don't feel like it was. And I love slow, artsy, pretentious films, but I don't feel like Tar was one. Tar is an engaging thriller. It's a ghost story about this woman being haunted, figuratively and literally, by her past, by people from her past, by herself, her own actions. And it's so engaging. I watched it the first time and I loved it. And I often think to myself, oh, I really like that. I'll go and watch it again. And I never do. Or if I do, I get a little bit bored and I think, you know, this is great, but I didn't want to watch it again. I went to watch Tar. You know, it's almost 3 hours long. I went to watch it again. It flew by. It did not feel like it's almost 3 hours. It's so well paced. It's so engaging. It keeps you hooked constantly. It's fabulous. It takes you into this world of, you know, elitism, classical music conducting, and you know, what's the word, composing, and you get hooked and you don't want to go. It's incredible. It's about, you know, this woman's downfall caused by herself and her own actions. Nina Hoss is an underrated performance. She should be nominated for Best Supporting Actress. She gives one of the best, most subtle and nuanced performances I've seen in a very long time. Some of the scenes where she's just sat down and she just glances, she says more in those scenes than most actresses can with an hour of screen time. She is remarkable in this film. And Cate Blanchett, obviously, she's always fab. This is maybe her best performance. It's an unbelievable performance. You know, it kind of, it's so character driven. It feels almost like a character acting rather than just a good performance. She completely becomes Lydia Tarr, and then it kind of all comes to a crescendo when she goes to her childhood home and breaks down. And you just, it's such an incredible film. It's so fabulous. It's so impeccably well done. The cinematography is beautiful, and it does exactly what it needs to do whenever it needs to do whenever it needs to do it. It's just perfect. I can't, you know, like I say, it's the kind of masterpiece that only comes along once every few years, and I think it will be remembered, and I think in many years to come we'll look back and go, how did that not sweep every award it was up for? It should have done. Apart from Best Actress, interestingly, I still think Michelle Yeoh is better than Cate Blanchett.
Whoa, that is a hot take.
That is a hot take, but I do.
We'll talk about that tomorrow, I guess. Okay.
What did you think of Tar?
Tar.
Well, I don't think it's exactly the same as every other film about a composer, and no new ground is being made here.
This, basically just watch Whiplash. It's just like a better version of this. Tar. When I watched Tar is the kind of film that when I watched it and I didn't know what to think of it for a while. You know, it really had to sit on me. This is, you know, there's an awful lot happening and there's a lot of awful lot to be interpreted. And there are a lot of things that I don't necessarily always know the motivation behind that, even now. But I have come to the conclusion that I think Tar is a very, very good film. I really did enjoy it. I think Blanchett is absolutely amazing. I think that before anything about this film gets said, the first thing that should be said is that Cate Blanchett is absolutely impeccable. I think she's the best I've ever seen her. And we'll talk about it more tomorrow. I do not think Michelle Yeoh is better than this. I don't think that anyone is close to this year. Arguably, I think across. I think the only person that comes, again, this is all conversation for next episode. I shouldn't be saying this. I think the only person that comes close is, or the only person that's in the conversation is Paul Mescal in Best Actor in terms of quality of performance. I think she is absolutely amazing. I don't feel the exact same way that you do about this film. I don't think it's a flawless masterpiece, but I do think it is very well made. I think it is very good. Funny enough, I do think you use the phrase, this is one of the kind of masterpiece that only comes around every few years. I think you've said that loads of times. I feel like I hear you say that all the time.
I probably do, but I really mean it about
about it, yeah. The same way you really meant that about The Northman and The Woman King. And
I don't think I said it about The Northman or The Woman King.
I think you might about The Northman, to be fair.
Maybe.
Anyway, amazing film, by the way. Didn't know for any awards anywhere, but amazing film. Anyway, if Tar was as good as its first hour, it would probably be like the best film ever made. I just think that it's the early stuff, which is I definitely the slower stuff, funny enough, I really, really loved. And I don't have any issue with the second half of the film. I think it's very strong. I just felt like it was a little overstuffed for me. You talk about pacing. I don't necessarily agree. I definitely felt the runtime. But yeah, I think this sounds very nitpicky. This sounds kind of a bit dumb of me. But for a film about an amazing composer, I don't think we see enough composing. Conducting. I'll use the word composing twice. For a film about an amazing conductor, we don't actually see that much conducting, which whenever it's shot, looks wonderful, sounds wonderful, acted wonderfully. I could not get my eyes off the screen when we actually saw music being performed, but it always seemed that we were seeing Lydia on her own practicing. We saw Olga performing. I don't think we saw enough of the music, and I know it doesn't necessarily add to the plot. I don't think it's necessary. But again, if I'm going to use the comparison I used earlier, Whiplash, you know, that film doesn't need those drumming scenes to make the film so good, but it definitely improves it. It definitely gives you a feel for the kind of what they're going through a lot more and a kind of more scope of the environment. Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson described it as a very funny, deeply funny film, and he received a lot of criticism. But I agree. I think Tar is a very funny film. I especially think that it is probably the best. The film itself is the kind of the best. It's the best. It's the best lead up to the greatest punchline in film history. Yeah. The last few minutes of Tar are so good, exceptionally funny. I did have the most issue with the 30 minutes that came before that, though, in the aftermath of the actions, which I think go too quickly as well. There's a lot of build up to, I don't know how to say it without spoiling it. There's an awful lot of
it's been out for a while. I feel like we can say spoilers.
Well, we're dealing with the allegations. The aftermath of the allegations, I think that all goes a bit too quickly. The way the allegations are dealt with, it's all a bit slap bang for me. I would like maybe a little bit more explanation of what happened, or perhaps kind of a bit more of a needle drop moment there where you really understand that the importance, the implications of this. That seems to go a bit too quickly, and I find that the kind of journey she goes on afterwards perhaps seems a little bit kind of unguided, seems a little bit kind of random to the audience. I don't know. But again, I'm focusing on the negatives. But Ultimately, yeah. I mean, the scene in Juilliard when she's
Oh, God, yes.
lecturing at some young non-binary student. Absolutely exceptional, you know, absolutely
Unbelievable.
exceptional.
Not just from a performance perspective, but from a filmmaking perspective. That's all one take, and the camera moves around. It puts you in the audience, so you feel like an audience member, and then it stands up and walks around with Cate Blanchett as she moves around, and it's just incredible, that scene.
You know, the thing is that this film feels like a biopic for a human that's never existed.
Yes.
And Tar, Lydia Tar, is, that's like James Bond, Tar, Lydia Tar, is built up so much. You know, she is kind of unbearable, regardless of her horrible actions. Just being in the room with her is almost unbearable.
Yeah.
And she's pretentious and snidey and horrible and malicious. And I think, as much as I've just said, you know, talk about Cate Blanchett, as much of that comes from one of the best scripts of the year as well. I mean, the screenwriting here from Top Field is amazing, you know, absolutely amazing. Especially in the in as in a, that the argument scene, but also when she's talking to her mentor over dinner and stuff, and she's talking to Sebastian. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Every line is so well thought of. Every nothing doesn't fit with the character. Everything is so well written. It's a masterful script. Yeah, I think it starts stronger than it ends. Not the actually the last minute is amazing, but the film, the start of the film is stronger than the ending. It takes a few kind of bizarre turns that I kind of appreciate. I don't necessarily get all of it. There are a lot of decisions in the film I don't fully understand. Maybe I'm just a bit too dumb. I would have liked to have seen a bit more music, but the music that we do see is absolutely amazing. The sound design on this is absolutely knock your socks off. Yeah, I mean, what I liked, I would like to have seen more of, but what I did like was exceptional. So I would consider myself, for all the negatives I said, a big Tar fan.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I'm a Tar head for sure.
Me too. Big Stan.
And you know what? Seeing as it's in National Women's Day, maybe she did nothing wrong.
You know, you could she go bust too close to the sun, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's a
Absolutely, she got
problematic
best careers.
queen.
Yes, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I also really like the kind of the reverse Psycho. You know, at the end of Psycho, you have just a massive dump of exposition right at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Instead, there's a massive exposition dump right at the beginning of the film,
Yes.
but it's presented through the form of a curated interview with the New York Times or something,
Yeah.
New Yorker, I think. And it's done in a way that does not feel intrusive. It doesn't feel like they're giving you information for information's sake. It does feel like a real interview, and everything they say is the kind of thing that would be posed to a composer.
Yeah.
Conductor.
Conductor.
Conductor. Sorry.
Oh,
It,
you're
yeah, so
exceptional.
it feels really natural, but it is also a really good way to just fill the audience in on every single detail of who this character is. So that was done well as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. To me, it's one of the best films I've seen in recent memory. It's the biggest standout for me. Like you say, is the screenplay. It's one of the most incredible, most thorough, well thought out screenplays ever. You know, it's absolutely fabulous.
But do I think it's the best screenplay of the year? You can find out on the next episode of the National Podcast.
Yes.
We already know your answer.
Do we?
I don't know. Maybe love. I don't know. What's like? Did anything weird get nominated for screenplay this year?
I don't
Like,
remember.
do you remember, like when Borat 2 got nominated a few years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Did Top Gun Maverick get a screenplay nomination?
It did not, I don't think.
I'm almost surprised.
I know. I it's horrible, isn't it?
Horrible, horrible. What isn't horrible is Tar, but what is horrible, as previously mentioned, is Mark Strong's wig. What is the thought process behind that? Why have they done that?
Nobody knows.
Well, I watched this film in the cinema with my mum, right? And I said to her afterwards, I was like, what is going on with Mark Strong's wig? And she went, yeah, as soon as he came on screen, I could tell it was him. But fucking no shit. Obviously. I could tell it was him. Like, they were trying to hide that it was Mark Strong. Yeah.
It's just this. It's great. Not the wig, the film.
Yeah. Also, big ups to an amazing snivelling worm of a character that is Sebastian in Tar as well.
Yes.
Some real top wormage on display there. Okay, what rating would you give Tar? I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10. It's a masterpiece.
I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10. It's a masterpiece.
Similarly to... I would give it an 8.5, same as I gave him quite a question from.
Fair enough. What about Man of the Match?
Man of the Match.
I know mine, if you want me to go first.
You're going to go for Todd Field for screenplay.
You know me so well. I am. Yeah. There are so many incredible aspects of this film. I was thinking about Florian Hofmeister. His cinematography is fabulous. And the directing from Todd Field. And of course... Cate Blanchett, but for me the big standout is the script. It's an incredible script. Are you going to give it to the cinematographer as usual? I doubt it. I don't feel like you are.
No, I barely mentioned cinematography, which is exceptional.
It is.
What a year it's been for cinematography, by the way. What a year for cinematography. Oh, yeah. I mean, just the like you can make. Empire of Light, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Oscar nominated Empire of Light. I'm going to give it to Cate Blanchett. And I know recently everyone has decided that after all this time of calling her Cate Blanchett, everyone's decided they need to actually pronounce her name right. But I, as a true Brexit geezer, I'm not going to change my pronunciation of her name. So I'm sticking to Cate Blanchett. Who is absolutely exceptional in this film. And as I said earlier, I think one of the best performances of the year. And yes, spoilers for tomorrow. I think she should win Best Actress.
Gag.
Gag indeed. Okay, very nice. We'll move on to The Banshees of Inisherin, which is available on Disney+. So it's easily accessible for all you at home. And is a film directed by Martin McDonagh, who is famous for directing In Bruges, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and the slightly less talked about Seven Psychopaths, and is set in Ireland in, is the time defined? It's kind of the 1800s-ish, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure it's the 1920s.
Is it really that? Okay.
I think so. Right. I think it's during the Irish Civil War. And I don't know when that happened.
Yes. Yeah,
it was in the 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, I could be only 21 years off. So.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's not the same 20s that are depicted in Babylon, though. Very different.
Yes. Yeah. There's no crossover there. No, that's an idea.
There's no Nelly Leroy cameo in this.
Banshees of Inisherin is set in Ireland in the 20s and follows Colin Farrell as a man who wakes up one day, goes about his usual routine to then find when he knocks on his best friend's house to invite him to the pub, that his best friend, played by Brendan Gleeson, does not like him anymore. And he has to try and find out why and try and resolve the situation. And features supporting performances from Kerry Condon, who plays the sister of Colin Farrell's character, and Barry Keoghan, who plays essentially the kind of village idiot type. All four of which named have been nominated for acting Oscars. Farrell for actor, Gleeson and Keoghan for supporting actor, and Kerry Condon for supporting actress. films have garnered a number of other nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director. And yes, so to be honest with you, I'm kind of over the anger that I had towards you during the All Quiet on the Western Front review. But I'm also just going to make you start anyway.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
What do you think of The Banshees of Inisherin?
I liked it. I liked it. I guess you could say this is a different war film. Set during the Irish Civil War, this is a different war film.
To be fair, it would be like a smarter point if you were like talking about it's a war film in terms of like the war of words that's going on between these two characters. But instead, you just said it's because it's in the 20s in the Irish Civil War.
Yeah.
There's a war in the distance.
There is a war in the distance. But yeah, there is also an internal
great line
going on. Yeah. I liked it. I liked it. It was good. It was very good. It was funny. It was heartbreaking. It was heartwarming.
You call yourself some sort of critic.
What?
You just said it's good 5 times in a row. It's good. It's funny.
It is good.
Yeah, elaborate.
I'm about to. It's good because... There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's good. The directing is great. Martin McDonagh's a great director. He's a great screenwriter as well. He's always been fabulous at writing very dark scripts that are upsetting and heartbreaking, but are also incredibly funny. I haven't seen Seven Psychopaths, but I've seen In Bruges and Three Billboards, and they're all very similar. You know, they're very dark plots. They're very sad plots, but they're made very funny and uplifting at the same time, and then there are also absolutely heartbreaking moments in there as well. And they're kind of anchored in this one by Colin Farrell, who is the central character in this film. Everything revolves around him and his pain that he's going through, the war, the internal war he's going through. And all the performances are fabulous. Colin Farrell is incredible. Brendan Gleeson is great as well. Barry Keoghan is the standout for me, I think. He's so kind of hopelessly optimistic. And, Kerry Condon is also incredible as well. But Barry Keoghan is the standout for me. One thing that I loved about this film and loved about Barry Keoghan's performance in particular is... this isn't a spoiler, really, but Colin Farrell, there's one moment where Colin Farrell says something to someone, and it's one of the funniest scenes in the film. And then about 40 minutes later or so, that scene is spoken about, and it becomes one of the saddest moments in the film because of Barry Keoghan. Barry Keoghan's reaction to one of the funniest moments is just heartbreaking. It's really good. You know, it's been a while since I've seen it, so you can take it away and refresh my memory a little bit, and then maybe I'll have more to say after you've gone on. Cinematography is great. The score is incredible. Loved the score and the production design and the costume design. It's all good. It's good.
I absolutely love The Banshees of Inisherin. I mean, I don't just like it. I absolutely adore it. I really do think it's in the upper echelon of films that I've seen this year. It's up there with the things that I'm not going to talk about the films that I've nominated for Oscars, because I'm not going to compare it to Oscars, but it's up there with things like The Northman and The Woman King that we've described on the podcast as being kind of an aftersun. Yes, it's in that kind of category for me. It's like you said, you know, it's the saddest tragedy. It's the funniest tragedy you'll ever see, or it's the saddest comedy. It's heartbreaking. It's emotional. It's essentially a very basic concept, you know, which is this guy doesn't want to be friends with him anymore. But for some reason, it's a really fascinating concept because it is kind of inhuman that doesn't really happen. You know, people don't break up with friends in the same way they do with partners. And it, the fact that he refuses to give you any reasoning is just so fascinating. It's like, of every single Agatha Christie mystery that's ever been written, none of them hold up to the intrigue that is led by him just saying he's only friends with him anymore. You are so driven to try and solve this problem, and you're so fascinated about these exact reasons why, especially early in the film before it's kind of more revealed. I agree. Kieran is the standout. Everyone is amazing. All four of them are amazing. I don't think enough is being said about Brendan Gleeson, to be honest with you. Simply because he's sharing the category with Keown, it's not like he'd get my vote. But I do think that not as enough has been said about how good Brendan Gleeson is here. He's always good. Yeah, exceptional actor. But I think the kind of bitterness, the world weariness, and the kind of sudden step into maturity that his character takes is portrayed wonderfully. It's all on the script. It's all on the script. Written by Martin McDonagh again, the director. It feels so Irish. It feels so, say, McDonagh. You know, it's such his typical style. And just seeing the chemistry between Farrell and Gleeson, I would watch it for 100 hours. On technical level, cinematography, my word, the cinematography is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. The scene with the flames, the scene on fire, beautiful. The scene on the beach, unbelievable. I mean, with these, again, it's a small island in a sharing. It's this kind of tiny island with very little people living on it, but the cinematography is all these sweeping nature shots that, you know, capture the kind of the greatness and the size of the nature of it, and makes these, you know, these people feel so small and absorbed by the island. It's exceptional. It's absolutely exceptional. I couldn't speak any higher of it, really. I can't think of an issue I have with it. And as you said, the scenes with Barry Keoghan, you know, he's Barry Keoghan's character is kind of a microcosm of McDonagh himself. You know, he's on paper, he's the comic relief, he's the village idiot, he's the fool, but he is the one that delivers two or three of the most heartbreaking moments. You know, the person you consider to be, you know, it's the whole film in a nutshell, really. But for me, the burial scene, I'm not going to say any more than that, is just that for me, maybe scene of the year. You know, in that conversation, scene of the year, in the conversation, I'm going to mention it again because it's in my brain. I don't know why I'm so obsessed with this film today. On the same level as the siege in the early section of The Northman, for example, it's up there with stuff like that. Or the scene when the monkey gets loose in Nope. You know, those kind of level quality scenes. It's got a million of those. It's so, I don't know, it's just so gripping. You just, the intrigue, the mystery, the conflict, and even though it's kind of small town conflict, it's local politics, the stakes are enormous, and the extent of what some of the stuff that happens, I really don't want to go into spoilers in case anyone hasn't seen it, but you know, you you can't always believe the extent that Brendan Gleeson's character goes to. Unbelievable for me. Unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable. I agree. I saw it at London Film Festival, which was a good like 6 months ago now. And so because it was London Film Festival, it was sold out. It was very busy. And I'll never, ever forget, towards the beginning of the film, after Brendan Gleeson says to him, "I just don't like you anymore. I don't want to talk to you anymore." The next morning, Colin Farrell wakes up and checks the calendar, and it's the 1st of April. And his face when he realizes, oh, it's an April Fool's joke. Everyone in the audience was like, oh no, he's getting his hopes up. And everyone let out the same noise of, oh, at the same time. That song, that's the one shot of Colin Farrell's face when he reads the calendar and realizes it was the 1st of April. Devastating. Devastating.
Yeah.
But also incredibly funny. It's such a complex film. It's fabulous.
Yeah. I agree with your point on the scores, just like a bit on the record. I did want to credit the score. But yeah. Yeah, fascinating. It's just, I think it shows, you know, just basically how interesting humans are, just human behavior. It's just fascinating just watching these two people, these two just ordinary people just completely just take over and just battle for this, their domain, their thought process, their way of life, their island. It's just, it's, yeah, what a meeting of minds. Is there a better trio than McDonough, Farrell and Gleeson?
Perhaps not. In Bruges, also fabulous.
Yeah. It's probably like Scorsese, De Niro and someone else. I don't know. Joe Pesci.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Really good.
Paul Rudd, Peyton Reed, and Kevin Feige.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, leave Jonathan Majors out of this. I'm gonna give it 9.5.
Really, not a 10. What's holding it back from being a 10?
I mean, nothing is really holding it back from being a 10, to be honest.
So give it a 10. Do it.
It's a 10. I'm giving it a 10.
It's a 10. It's a 10. You heard it here first. I'm going to give it a 9. I'm going to give it a 9. It was fabulous. I just didn't love it quite as much as you did, but still very high praise. 9 out of 10 from me.
Yeah.
Who is your man of the match?
I loved watching it.
Yeah.
You know, I really loved watching it. I was just having a great time.
It was great. That, and like I said, that was watching the dark it in a days sold of the out cinema as well. Was fab.
I saw it on my laptop, but I saw my laptop in the midst of a grueling dissertation. So it really gave me some much needed relief.
Yeah.
My man of the match is going to be, cinematographer. I want to say Mary Keown. I am saying Martin McDonagh for the screenplay. It is hilarious and miserable and horrible and aggressive and surprisingly violent and so unbearably Irish.
My man of the match is going to be, I struggled with this one, but I'm going to give it to Jenny the Donkey.
Let's go.
No, I would love to give it back to, I would love to give it to Jenny the Donkey, but yeah, it's Martin McDonagh for the screenplay. It's very, very, very well written.
Mm.
And maybe we think he should win the Oscar. Find out tomorrow, maybe.
I thought you were putting, for a second, I thought you were just putting the words in my mouth. Like you were just saying that I thought he should win Best Director.
No. Maybe that's what you think, but we'll find out tomorrow.
Yeah, I actually didn't really talk about the direction, to be fair. But the direction is obviously amazing.
It is.
But yeah. Yeah, nice. Good shit. So we only really disagreed once.
Yeah, it was quite a big disagreement, though, for once.
It was quite a big disagreement. But then the way you feel about Tar is more so the way I feel about Banshees, and the way that I feel about Banshees is more so how you feel about Tar.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair assessment.
Do you think it's because
nobody cares about All Quiet on the Western Front?
I'm just a happy, jolly guy, and you're a middle-aged woman in a man's body.
Who loved
You're a Tar. Middle-aged...
I love problematic conductor.
Yeah, you're a middle-aged conductor in a man's body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds fun.
Sounds fun, to be honest.
It does.
I'll tell you another great scene. Talking scenes of the year, the accordion scene in Tar.
Oh, apartment for sale. Yes.
Apartment for sale.
I remember reading loads of people saying Apartment for Sale should be nominated for Best Original Song. And I didn't realize that was a joke. So when it happened in the film, I was like, oh my God, for the past few months, I've been seeing people say Apartment for Sale should be nominated for Best Original Song, thinking it's this intricate, incredible piece of music that Lydia Tarr composes. And then it's that. It's great.
Yeah. Do you think Tarr was robbed of Best Hair and Makeup nomination for Mark Strong? For Mark Strong.
Definitely.
Do you think Mark Strong should have been in the spot that Judd Hirsch was in? Find out tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Find out tomorrow.
I mean, not really, because we're not really going to be talking about the things that didn't get nominated. We probably should have done an episode from that as well, actually. We should have said, like, oh, were these... I think one year we did do that, and we thought, like, were these the right nominations?
Well, maybe we can talk about that tomorrow. We can be like, oh, I don't think that, you know... they should have got nominated.
Judging off this, we've said, like, we're going to talk about this tomorrow about 30 times. So, like, is this going to be like a 4-hour podcast? We're not Next Best Picture. Seriously, their podcasts are fucking so long. No, like, nothing wrong with it. Like, you know, each their own. But they are like 4 hours long.
Yeah, we will try and keep it under 4 hours. Yeah, this is a promise. We've never gone over 3 hours.
Yes, we did. I think we have, and we've
I
split it.
I don't think we have. Right? Oh, that's right. We may have split it.
Yeah. Also, the last episode with Matt Neglia and another critic who I'm not going to name that didn't ever get released.
I was not on that episode.
Just technical issues. It rhymes with Derek Weber.
I am not associated with that episode. That was before I joined the podcast.
That episode, unedited, that episode was like 3 hours and 38 minutes or something.
Well, so, it doesn't exist.
That doesn't exist, so you can't sit through three and a half hours of
Derek Weber.
Of Derek Weber. Right, okay. That was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was lovely.
You know, I don't feel any faith that we can ever do anything we're ever going to say we're going to do.
Yeah, I don't feel like we're going to do an episode tomorrow talking about the Oscars.
I feel a rare feeling of confidence that we will release an episode.
Really?
The day after you're listening to it. I feel like we are going to do that.
Wow.
I feel like we just don't, there's no more time after this. So if an episode doesn't go up...
We're recording on this Thursday night. The Oscars are on Sunday.
Yes. So we're going to be recording the next episode on Friday night. So probably like an hour before it gets uploaded. Probably, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll see. But anyway...
Don't make any promises. This episode might not be released for another week.
I promise to the Now Showing audience, you will be receiving an episode... within a day of this episode going up.
There will be two episodes before the Oscars. The 95th Oscars, 2023 Oscars.
Well, I wouldn't say that Oscars.
Okay.
Also, we'll go that far.
This is a nitpick, but the Oscars this year have been... like, every year they have a little branding thing. This year they've been branded as Oscars 95, which to me means Oscars 1995. And I don't like it.
They've also
changed the hashtag emoji. It used to just be an Oscar, now it's Jimmy Kimmel holding an Oscar. Don't like that either.
Which was Jimmy Kimmel?
I don't know how to describe Jimmy Kimmel. He's the one who hosted the Oscars last time. Oh no, it wasn't. It was famously Chris Rock.
Chris Rock didn't host the Oscars.
Oh no, he didn't, did he?
He just gave an award out. It was Amy Schumer and two other women.
Wanda Sykes.
Yeah, Wanda Sykes and someone else.
Yeah, you're right.
The one that was in Scream 2. No, she was in Scary Movie or something.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Oh my God, what's she called? Oh my
Regina
God.
Regina something?
Regina Hall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It was not hosted by Chris Rock.
No.
But Chris Maroc was there. Do you remember him being there? It's not like anything eventful happened.
Oh, God. Even
how many jokes about the slap are we going to get this year?
Which slap?
Yeah, we're going to watch the Oscars together. We should play a drinking game. We should take a shot every time someone makes a joke about the slap.
We fucking slaughtered.
I guarantee it's one of the first things out of Jimmy Kimmel's mouth.
Like, you could describe Jimmy Kimmel to me and there's absolutely no chance I'll know which American talk show host he is.
Yeah, I have no idea
which one is Fallon. Like, he could be Fallon.
I don't think he's hosted the Oscars. Fallon, I don't think he's hosted the Oscars.
So it doesn't help me. Like, I don't remember who hosted the Oscars.
Wow, clearly not.
I remember when presenters say shit that's funny. Like the time they got the Best Picture winner wrong. Like, I remember that. But that I don't remember funny. Who hosted that year. I remember
Jimmy Kimmel hosted that year.
Yeah. Right, okay. Anyway.
And he's hosting the 1995 Oscars as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, what about James Corden? Oh, he's an American talk show host.
No.
And arguably snubbed at the Oscars for his role in Cats, the 2019 film.
Cats, wow. I thought you were going to say The Prom.
Yeah. I was tempted to say The Prom, you know.
He did get a Golden Globe nomination for that, so you could argue he was snubbed.
I haven't seen The Prom, but it has been revealed in the National Podcast.
It has. I famously said that it set gay rights back by at least a decade.
Did you?
I did.
I don't listen to your reviews. I wonder what's the most obscure film reviewed in this podcast. Oh, actually, I know the answer to that. The answer is Schemers. Okay, anyway.
Do you think?
Yeah, come on. That was released in 10 cinemas in the UK.
Yeah, that's true.
Which was also a very underrated film. Very enjoyable.
Yeah, it
was good. Yeah, very good film. Okay.
Back when we had an episode every week, so we had to review things like that.
Yeah, back when we had a decent co-host.
No, I will not take the flack for this.
I'm not saying anything. I just... Yeah, nothing to do with the time. I was just saying, that was back when we had a decent co-host.
Wow. Well.
Yeah.
Jordan Luke
McDonald. We've been waffling for ages.
We have.
Shout out Charlie again. Okay.
Hi,
Charlie. Okay. We'll see you in a very short amount of time.
We will. We'll see you in less than 24 hours.
Yes. Okay, goodbye.
Are you not going to do the normal
outro? Oh, shit, no, wait. Don't. Sorry, if you ended the podcast then, unpause it, because I've got more to say. Sorry, this has been a while since I've done this. Right, so if you want to follow the podcast on Twitter, you can do so at NowSharingPod. If you want to follow us individually, you can do so at SamHMedia and LewisJWR. You can work out who's who. You can find us on Letterboxd at Sam Houston and what's yours?
Lewis JWR.
Well? Yeah. Yeah. You can contact the podcast directly at nowsharingpod@gmail.com, but no one ever does. If you like the podcast, the best thing you can do is tell your friends about it. And also give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. If there's a rating system, give us a 5-star, please. It helps us go up in the rankings. Thank you very much, guys, for listening, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.